Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments, and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice by Karen L. Cox. Narrated by David Sadzin. Introduction. 31 years ago, I was working as a museum historian in Fayetteville, North Carolina, when I first encountered the United Daughters of the Confederacy, UDC, also commonly known as the Daughters. I was assisting a colleague and woodworker who had salvaged timber from the Confederate women's home that once stood in Fayetteville, and he wanted to know more about the home's origins. My research took me to the local library, where I culled through the microfilm of the local paper. The home, which opened in 1915, was the project of the UDC. Members had lobbied and received a $10,000 appropriation from the state legislature to construct the building and another $5,000 per year to maintain it. This was an impressive amount of money at the time, but it was the dedication of the home that got my attention. The event took up the entire front page of the Fayetteville Observer. Political dignitaries from across the state, including a representative from the governor's office, attended the dedication. What struck me was that during a time when women did not have the right to vote, this women's organization was clearly plugged in to the most powerful men in the state. It had gotten funds from the state legislature for its project, and these same men answered when the Daughters called them to be present for a dedication ceremony. I wanted to know more and began interviewing women who had been members of the organization ever since they had been drafted into the group's auxiliary, the Children of the Confederacy, and who knew the women behind the Confederate Women's Home. Over and over, I heard the words powerhouse in relation to these early UDC members, though I was only just beginning to grasp the impact of their work on the South. As I discovered in my research, the Daughters indeed made up the most powerful women's organization in the South in the early 20th century. A group of 30 women founded the UDC in 1894 at a meeting in Nashville, Tennessee. Some of them had lived through the Civil War, while others had grown up in its aftermath. From this core group, the UDC grew rapidly into an organization of 100,000 by the First World War. Leaders established a wide-ranging agenda, but their fundamental mission was to shape the way future generations of white Southerners remembered the Civil War, the Confederacy, and slavery, as well as to vindicate the men and women of the Confederate generation. Their efforts provided white Southerners with a reason to take pride in Confederate heritage and to defend that heritage, including white supremacy, even in the face of a changing South. The enormous influence these Southern women wielded provoked my curiosity and led me to write about their history and impact on Southern culture in my first book, Dixie's Daughters, The United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Preservation of Confederate Culture. I dug into the history of, motivations for, and rituals surrounding Confederate monuments and the UDC's role in placing this statuary in cities and towns throughout the South and even outside of the region. At the time, I regarded the early 20th century as a natural endpoint for my work, since the vast majority of the Daughters' statues were erected by World War I. I thought my work on this topic was complete. But the history of Confederate monuments is not limited to those who built them or to those who venerated the lost cause. Rather, these monuments are part of a longer history that is also mired in racial inequality and modified by black resistance. And as events since 2015 have made clear, the monuments the Daughters built continue to maintain a tight hold on Southern politics, Southern history, and the Southern landscape where they still stand. Through a broad-based agenda to perpetuate Confederate memory, the Daughters gave inspiration to Southern white men intent on dominating black Southerners at every step, and by violence, if necessary. Two generations removed from the Civil War, These women saw their efforts as part of an overall program of vindicating the Confederacy and those who sought to preserve it. Their battle to maintain Confederate culture by perpetuating pro-Southern history, educating white children, and yes, building monuments, required that the men of their generation be victorious in creating a Southern power structure that their forefathers had failed to achieve. And they were. Those men established a political foundation based on white supremacy, disfranchised black men, compelled entire black communities into submission through racial violence, and wielded states' rights like a saber to thwart racial progress, while the federal government turned a blind eye and the Supreme Court upheld segregation. While states' rights for the Confederate generation meant a state's right to maintain slavery, states' rights for the Jim Crow generation meant maintaining the racial status quo through laws and customs that gutted African Americans' rights as citizens, underfunded their schools, re-enslaved them through mass incarceration, and made it nearly impossible for black Southerners to break free from systems of inequality that limited where they could live and work. African American efforts toward empowerment during Reconstruction did not fall by the wayside even during these reversals, nor did their explicit resistance against Confederate icons, including monuments. Generations later, it continues. Confederate monuments are not innocuous symbols. Though in the past they were used by white Southerners to teach about a mythological noble heritage completely stripped of the story of slavery, what they teach is not history. They are weapons in the larger arsenal of white supremacy, artifacts of Jim Crow not unlike the whites-only signs that declared black Southerners to be second-class citizens. Removing a monument from the public square is no more an act of erasing history than removing these signs from public accommodations. Just as history teaches us that those signs once existed, we can be assured that even after these monuments' removal, the books, photographs, postcards, unveiling speeches, old tourist brochures, and Chamber of Commerce promotional materials that documented them will continue to exist. Removal, of course, does not mean certain destruction. Yes, some statues have been damaged over the course of protests, but most have been removed to storage while cities determine their fate. Some have been moved to cemeteries for Confederate soldiers, and others await a calmer time when they might find a home on a battlefield park. Still others have been returned to the chapters of the UDC whose forebears first funded them. It could be that some Confederate monuments will be placed with museums of art or history where proper context can be provided, although some critics worry that such placement would mean creating shrines to the Confederacy. The wide variety of possible fates for these monuments should come as no surprise, because most are intensely local objects. How a city, town, or university determines the fate of its Confederate monument, or if it does nothing at all, will underscore that community's values, even when it doesn't reflect the wishes of the entire community. Yet once that decision is made and executed, it is important for these communities to grasp that the story is not over. Removing a monument does not remove the systemic racism with which it has long been associated. It is a symbolic act only, although it may also serve as an important first step. The hard work of dismantling racism and honestly confronting racial inequality within that community must come next. After all, it was a movement against white supremacy that initially brought public concerns about Confederate monuments into the open. Today's protests against Confederate monuments, therefore, are but one stage in a much longer fight for racial justice. Since 2015, Confederate monuments have transcended local debates to become a national issue. This is because such symbols challenge the narrative of American democracy and question whether there is truly liberty and justice for all. Yet the escalation of this debate has led not to an honest conversation, but to a polarization of political sides and a series of moves meant to further entrench Confederate monuments. GOP legislators throughout the South have responded to the prospect of a reckoning on the local level through legislative schemes. In a number of Southern states, monument laws, sometimes referred to as Heritage Protection Acts, have removed local communities' ability to make decisions about the future of the statues that dominate their town squares and courthouse lawns. These laws prevent local redress and make petitions meaningless, often written by legislators who rose to positions of power through district gerrymandering, itself linked to voter suppression. These monument laws in practice invite continued protests and vandalism of monuments. When these laws have proved insufficient to head off a growing movement, the federal government has inserted itself into the dispute. On June 26, 2020, President Donald J. Trump issued an executive order to further criminalize vandalism and violence against monuments across the United States, including Confederate statues in places where state and local authorities have removed them. All the while, grassroots protests have persisted, and monuments have been vandalized and toppled as never before in American history, because citizens have been left with virtually no legal avenues for change. Not all citizens are clamoring for monument removal. In November 2019, Elon University polled North Carolina residents on whether Confederate monuments should remain on public property. The poll's findings showed that a substantial majority of residents, 65%, believed monuments should remain on government-owned property, although an even higher percentage favored adding contextual panels or plaques. According to political scientist James Husser, director of the Elon University poll, the difference of opinion essentially boiled down to differing perceptions of history. Those viewing the Civil War as more about states' rights than slavery, Husser noted, were more likely to favor keeping monuments in place. The poll results also indicate how powerful the lost cause narrative remains. In an era defined by gerrymandering, voter suppression, and overwhelming displays of police violence, Confederate monuments have become a natural battleground for protests against systemic racism. The steady drumbeat of public outrage, legislative overreach, and local demonstrations reveals how the existing push and pull surrounding Confederate monuments has steadily escalated since the Charleston massacre in 2015. In the aftermath of that tragedy, very few statues were removed, while new monument laws were passed and existing state laws were amended to make removal even more difficult. Following the violent white supremacy on display at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017, several more monuments were removed, some extra-legally. Once more, states tightened their heritage laws, and the push for removal again quieted, though only temporarily. The police killing of George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, on May 25, 2020, in Minneapolis, reignited the struggle. White police officers arrested Floyd for allegedly paying for cigarettes with a counterfeit $20 bill, then wrestled him to the ground. After Floyd's hands were tied behind his back, Officer Derek Chauvin placed his knee on Floyd's neck and held it there for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, cutting off his ability to breathe and causing his death. George Floyd's murder, which was videotaped by bystanders, set off a series of massive Black Lives Matter protests across the United States and around the globe. And in the South, those protests took aim at Confederate statues, most notably on Richmond, Virginia's Monument Avenue. Many monuments were covered in graffiti, and some were ripped from their pedestals, because what protesters saw in George Floyd's death was what they saw symbolized by Confederate monuments: white supremacy, and systemic racism. The intensity of these protests presented numerous Southern cities and towns with a crisis. Many hoped to avoid a scenario similar to that in Richmond, but were hamstrung by their own state's draconian monument laws, as well as by the very real fear of white supremacist backlash and violence. Nonetheless, several statues were removed, either in spite of those laws or because local governments used loopholes to facilitate their removal. Monument removals during the summer of 2020 led journalists and scholars alike to wonder aloud whether this represented a turning point in the history of Confederate monuments. Significantly more statues were being removed than after events in Charleston or Charlottesville. Was this the end of their dominion over the Southern landscape? In reality, the total number of removals represented a small percentage of Confederate monuments overall. The Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, has documented more than 1,700 monuments, markers, and memorials that have been dedicated to the Confederacy over the course of U.S. history. Of this number, approximately 750 to 800 are Confederate statues. Popular rhetoric about the demise of Confederate monuments in the South has been greatly exaggerated, to say the least. Even the number of monuments that currently stand is difficult to pin down with certainty. The SPLC dataset on Confederate symbols is an ongoing project, so the numbers that appear in media accounts, including several news items based on data mining, fluctuate somewhere between 771 and 830 monuments. As recently as the spring of 2020, however, some news outlets erroneously presented the 1,700 figure as the total number of monuments, rather than the total of monuments and other markers and memorials. Given the wide variance, I traveled to Montgomery, Alabama, in early March 2020, just before the COVID-19 quarantine, where I met with members of the SPLC team responsible for the report on monuments, published under the title Whose Heritage?, which is based on the organization's data collection. When I asked what they made of the discrepancy in figures in the press, the response was, "We created the data set. We cannot control how it gets used." Ultimately, allowing for important caveats related to the precision of these numbers, I believe that the figure of 750 to 800 monuments represents a fair estimate of those erected. Even allowing for the most recent wave of monument removals, several hundred remain. The difficulty in making sense of how many statues are out there is indicative of just how much remains unsettled about the timeline of monument building over the past century. We know that the vast majority were erected in the period between 1890 and 1920. Yet another narrative that emerged in the media since the SPLC data were released is that a second explosion of monument building occurred during the Civil Rights era. This may have to do with a report issued by the Equal Justice Initiative claiming that there were scores of new monuments built in mid-century. While in Montgomery, I also met with an Equal Justice Initiative attorney who, unlike the SPLC team, would not provide the organization's data. The SPLC data do not confirm a significant increase in monument building at mid-century. And until the Equal Justice Initiative can show its work, historians, journalists, and those studying this history should rely on the SPLC's data. This means that while there were new monuments built in the 1950s and 1960s, the most reliable numbers reveal that approximately only 20 statues were erected in each decade, some of which were part of the Civil War centennial celebration that was taking place at the height of the Civil Rights Movement between 1961 and 1965. And while the final tally of how many hundreds of Confederate monuments were built over the past 150 years may hint at the considerable funds and efforts put toward their construction, this raw number does not provide us with a full accounting of the history of Confederate monuments. This book offers a place to start. As its chapters reveal, the real story of Confederate monuments is about how existing monuments became flashpoints in the crusade for white supremacy, as well as in the struggle for civil rights. To understand their history is to understand how white Southerners memorialized men who fought in a war to preserve slavery and created a new South that sought to limit the freedom of black Southerners whose ancestors were enslaved. Yet, at the same time, to fully understand their history is also to understand how generations of black Southerners have demonstrated their scorn for monuments they have always believed were symbols of slavery and oppression. This places Confederate statues, especially those that sit on the grounds of courthouses and state capitals, at the center of the ongoing fight for racial justice. What does it mean to say that there is no common ground where Confederate monuments are concerned? Generations of white Southerners have shared the belief that these symbols represented a particular Southern heritage imbued with nostalgia for Confederate soldiers that also erases slavery as a cause of war. Conversely, generations of black Southerners have regarded Confederate monuments as honoring men who fought to perpetuate human slavery. These competing interpretations began soon after the Civil War ended and have remained intact ever since. Neither side has budged, and there has been no common ground about what these monuments mean, not even in the physical spaces where they stand. What should have been common ground, democratic spaces where votes were cast, justice was decided, local laws were passed, and ordinary people lived out their lives, has been dominated by statues whose very existence condemned black Southerners to second-class citizenship. Where such symbols continue to stand unchallenged, what common ground can be found? 3 decades after beginning my research into the UDC, it seemed as though I couldn't escape the history of Confederate monuments, no matter how much I wanted to put it behind me. By the fall of 2019, I had spent 2 years giving talks about Confederate monuments at universities, museums, libraries, and for community groups. I was sick of talking about the damned monuments, returning to the lost cause and the people who distorted Southern history and propped up white supremacy for a century and a half after losing the Civil War was the last thing I wanted to do. Community organizers helped to change my mind. In February 2018, a group committed to improving the city of Louisville, Kentucky, for all citizens invited me to participate in the West Louisville Forum, which inspired me. That talk, and another I gave in Morganton, North Carolina, in January 2020, were both organized by ministers, one African-American and one white. Interracial groups of more than 200 people attended each event, revealing that ordinary people hungered for a better understanding of the role Confederate monuments have played in their communities. I was also inspired by the story of a 39-year-old woman named LaPetra Bell from Shreveport, Louisiana. I discovered her through a 2018 documentary produced by the New York Times called Taking a Knee and Taking Down a Monument. Bell's son, who played for his high school football team, wanted to take a knee as a display of solidarity with former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Bell realized that if her son could take a stand for something he believed in, she could too. So, she spoke before the Shreveport City Council about removing the Confederate monument that had stood on the Caddo Parish Courthouse grounds since 1905. Their convictions came with consequences for the Bell family, who faced vicious racial hatred in response to their stance against racism, but they stayed strong. I reached out to offer Ms. Bell moral support because I understood the stakes as much as she did. She told me that she had received some disturbing messages. In a later exchange, I wrote that from her example, I learned what real courage looks like. She brushed me off, and in the process told me something that has stuck with me ever since. "Please don't give me credit for this," she replied. "It was done because I'm desperate. I just wanted to make sure my children have a better world and not have to repeat history." Women like LaPetra Bell should never be desperate to be heard or taken seriously. This book tells the history of Confederate monuments since 1865 through the debates that surrounded them and the movements that arose to erect, defend, oppose, and remove them. It is focused on community-based monuments rather than those erected on battlefields, because it is in communities where debates over the meaning of these statues have primarily taken place. The story begins with the Lost Cause, how white Southerners came to enshrine that idea in stone, and how their reshaping of the Southern landscape shored up a revisionist narrative of the Civil War. At the same time, the book documents an African-American legacy of protest against Confederate statues that surfaced as the first ones were being erected in the 19th century. In the chapters that follow, Confederate monuments are revealed to sit at the intersection of so much that shaped the South in the 20th and 21st centuries, including Jim Crow segregation, racial violence, civil rights marches, Southern politics, the rise of neo-Confederates, and grassroots activism. Every one of the hundreds of Confederate monuments that dot the Southern landscape has a history, as do those that have been removed. More often than not, they are local histories that include women in the UDC, white male power brokers, the black laborers who helped build the foundations on which monuments were placed, unveiling rituals, Confederate Memorial Day ceremonies, racial violence, and social protest. This book does not seek to provide a comprehensive history of each and every statue that exists. Rather, it places the subject of Confederate monuments in its proper historical context and explores how these objects have been used by a variety of historical actors whose motivations also varied. There are many ways in which a book on the history of Confederate monuments can be written. I fully expect other historians will add to this literature. I also believe that scholars representing different disciplines, from art historians to sociologists to political scientists, can expand our discussions about Confederate monuments, as many already have. This is my contribution. It is the product of 30-plus years of wrangling with these statues and the women who placed them there. The stark new light that recent events have cast on these statues reveals how their long dominion over the Southern landscape has affected the history of the South, the nation, and all Americans. But how to reckon with that history is up to the communities living in the monument's shadows. 1. Rewriting History in Stone. In order to understand monuments of any kind, it is important to grasp the intentions and motivations of those who sought to erect a monument in the first place. This holds true for Confederate monuments, which have dominated the Southern landscape for more than 150 years. They were placed there by white Southerners whose intentions were not to preserve history, but to glorify a heritage that did not resemble historical facts. By erecting these statues, white Southerners have, over time, upheld a past in which the ideals of Confederate nationalism rest on metaphorical pedestals of heroism and sacrifice, while at the same time they negate the legacy of slavery and suggest that all white Southerners were committed to the Confederate cause, which they were not. Over time, monument supporters concocted new language to defend the South's monuments or to employ them in the defense of the region itself. In the 1950s, the Confederate tradition expanded to include Cold War rhetoric that warned Southern whites that the Civil Rights Movement and federal intrusion were linked to communism. In the immediate post-Civil Rights era, words like equality were employed in the defense of monuments, while during the era of multiculturalism, supporters argued the need to protect Confederate American heritage. During the post-9/11 years, monument defenders likened removal to the Taliban's destruction of cultural artifacts. The target kept shifting because the statues were not about history. Rather, they symbolized something even more precious to the cause of white supremacy, protecting the Southern way of life. Consequently, it is not a stretch to argue that removing a monument is not removing history, at least not the history of the Confederacy. Rather, the real history of these statues and markers is about their impact as objects.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?